From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Britain, France, Germany, and Italy have all just decided to join China's new Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, or AIIB, a potential rival to the World Bank, to the world order of the so-called American century, the era of America as number one. Is that era passing? Does it need to? Is it being closed by America's own political dysfunction? Gridlock. This hour on Point. Is the American century over? Is our own dysfunction killing it? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are we blowing a future that should be strong? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's just listen to a little cavalcade of sound here. Different voices from America. This one very famous, 1961, President John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, saying the United States would do whatever it took to uphold its principles.
Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
Bear any burden, said JFK. That's 1961. Well, let's think a couple of months ago here, Rush Limbaugh.
There's always going to be an America, folks. It may not always be the America that was founded. And it looks like, depending on what happens these next 2 years, it looks like that what really is being sliced apart here is America as a superpower. When we speak of America in decline, that's really what is in decline here.
We've got more sound. We'll dive on in, but let's dive in right there. Two fine thinkers right on this subject with us today from New York. John Cassidy, staff writer for The New Yorker. His recent big essay is headlined, "The Biggest Threat to America's Future is America." You can find it at our website, onpointradio.org. John Cassidy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Wonderful to have you. Also with me in the studio today, Joseph Nye, professor and former dean at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. His brand new book is the American Century Over? You can find an excerpt at our website as well. Joe Nye, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be with you.
Joe, your answer is no, it's not over. It needn't be over, at least for another 25 years. You don't push your prognosis beyond that, but you do say that while there are strengths on many fronts, American political dysfunction is a real risk factor.
There is a problem. I think it's not that China is going to overtake us, which is the conventional wisdom, but it's that we're going to not be able to exercise the influence that goes with the power that we will have. It's not the first time this has happened to us. After World War I, the United States was the most powerful country in the world, but then we turned to isolationism in the 20s and 30s and failed to block the rise of Hitler, counter Stalin's Russia. And in that sense, we were absent because of internal factions and dissent between isolationists and interventionists in the 30s. So we've been here before where we've essentially been the most powerful but not been able to exercise our power because of internal divisions.
John Cassidy, isolationism is one thing. At least it's a deliberate choice not to go abroad. Dysfunction is something else, John, and you write about it in relationship to this Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. What do you see embedded in the story of what's just happened there? Share it with us.
Well, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank is an institution that China has set up to invest in other countries in Asia. It's an international bank. They've invited other countries to join. And some of America's closest allies, including the United Kingdom and Germany and Italy and France, have said that they will.
Over vigorous protests from Washington saying, please
yeah, exactly.
don't.
I mean, the Obama administration sees this as an attempt by China to sort of do an end run around the existing international institutions, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the Asian Development Bank, which is based in Manila, all of which are, if not dominated, heavily influenced by the United States. So the United States asked the allies not to do this, but the allies have turned around and said, well, hang on a minute. We had this agreement with you and with China to increase China's influence in these institutions. An agreement was reached in 2010. But Congress has let it sit on the shelf and effectively killed it last year. It's a classic case of sort of Washington paralysis. And China has then turned around and said, well, even if America can't act, we'll act by ourselves. So it's not an enormous issue in itself, but it's a sort of classic case of how Washington dysfunction is undermining American authority around the world.
So I don't know if your editors took your essay and ran with it in the headline, but the biggest threat to America's future is America. Paint the broader mural here. What do you see, John?
Well, I mean, I agree with Professor Nye. I think we're on the same page on the sort of fundamental outlook for America. The American economy is still number one. We're still number one in innovation, productivity, GDP. That's not going to change over the next 20 or 30 years, even if China continues growing as it is, and it'll probably slow down a bit. But what I think the danger is a sort of gradual undermining of American influence and power around the world because of paralysis in the political system at home. And that this Asian Development Bank's story is a sort of straw in the wind, I think. We see it in lots of other areas too. Challenges, the American political system just seems increasingly unable to deal with the challenges the country faces. Not just in foreign policy, we're seeing it in Iran over differences over the Iranian nuclear deal, but in domestic policy too. Almost everybody agrees that America's infrastructure is decaying, that we're not spending as much as we should be on scientific research and areas like that. But because of the budget paralysis, which has been in effect now for at least 15 years, there just doesn't seem any way around it, and it's hard looking ahead to see how that is going to change. So what we're seeing is a gradual sort of undermining of the foundations of the U.S. By itself. And that's what I'm saying. The U.S. is a bigger threat to itself than the sort of military powers overseas. In military terms, we still spend more money on defense than the next eight powers combined. So I don't think there's any real threat there to U.S. dominance. It's a political threat.
Joe Nye, you have famously dissected, written about, put forward the idea of soft power. This is an area where the United States has traditionally, in the 20th century anyway, gained a lot of power. You say in your book, is the American century over? You say no. You say the foundations remain strong, as John says. I'd like you to lay those out for us. But you also talk about this critical problem, potentially critical problem of difficulty in converting fundamental strength into real strength in the world if we're gridlocked, paralyzed, dysfunctional. Let's point first to the strengths, if you would, that you see still with the capacity to go strong.
Well, if you look at America's position in terms of demography, our share of the world population, we're the only developed country which will be ranked in the same order at 2050 as we are today. Today, the world is basically China, India, U.S. In 2050, according to U.N. demographers, it'll be India, China, U.S.
China's population aging rapidly, like Japan's.
Right, and like Europe's and Russia's, mm-hmm. and so forth. Whereas the United States is going to maintain its position. Another area where—
Because of immigration? Because
immigration,
of internal growth
we have
rate?
A somewhat higher fertility rate mm-hmm. than Europe, for example. But also immigration is a great source of strength for us, even though it's controversial.
Okay.
Fortunately, we are not shutting it off. We don't know how.
So sheer numbers of people we're holding when many are not.
Right. And then the second area I'd note is energy. A few years ago, people were talking about our hopeless decline in energy, that we're becoming more and more dependent. In fact, now the International Energy Agency projects that North America will probably not have to import energy in the 2020s. And this is a result of technology and shale and producing shale gas and shale oil. A third area that I would cite is technology. In the new technologies that are crucial for the 21st century, biotechnology, nanotechnology, next generation of information technology, it's pretty well regarded that the United States is in the lead in all of these. And fourth, and backing that up, is the role of American universities. If you look at the Chinese ranking of American universities, Shanghai Jiao Tong University has its own ranking, 15 of the top 20 are American, none are Chinese. So these are some examples. Add to that an entrepreneurial culture, a way to deep and rich capital markets, a way to transfer these ideas into productivity. The Americans are actually in pretty strong shape. But I do agree with John Cassidy that if we don't pull ourselves together, we will lose a certain capacity to to use these power resources, and we'll also lose that attractiveness, which is soft power.
You write, in a world of growing complexity, the long-standing American inefficiency in power conversion, and you're talking about taking all those strengths and turning them into power in the world, may become a critical problem. How close are we to it being a critical problem?
Well, I think right now we're in a difficult spell. I guess the question is whether we're going to see this getting worse and worse, or whether whether it's something that's cyclical, that we go up and down on this. It's worth having a historical perspective on this. When George Washington was president and Thomas Jefferson was Secretary of State, Jefferson opposed the Jay Treaty, which was Washington's crucial treaty with Britain.
With Britain, yeah.
And what's more, he tried to get the Congress to defund it. So this kind of dysfunctional behavior has been around for a long time.
It wasn't the 47 Republican senators writing to Iran who were the first out on this edge.
Yeah,
maybe.
They're the most egregious recent example. But the point is that
But did Jefferson write to the King of England and say, reject this treaty?
Not quite, but the message got across.
Yeah.
I think the important thing is to ask whether this American government was created to be inefficient. It was we decided the way to handle power was to fragment it and have checks and balances. Our government, as the joke goes, was created so that King George couldn't rule over us and neither could anybody else. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it was designed to preserve liberty, not to be efficient. And that leads to excesses. The question is whether the excesses we're seeing now, which are in this period are pretty bad, are they something that's going to get worse, or are we going to see an upturn? Remember, in 1995, the government shut down because of Newt Gingrich's fight with Bill Clinton.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's future and American dysfunction, how long this country can, will stay on top, number one, and how our decisions, politics, behavior now factor into that. My guests are Joseph Nye of Harvard, author of the new book, Is the American Century Over? His answer is no, at least for another quarter century or so. We'll talk about that. But there are risks, and they go to this difficulty of turning our strengths into real power in the world in a period of paralysis, gridlock, dysfunction. John Cassidy is with us, staff writer for The New Yorker. His recent article headlined, "The Biggest Threat to America's Future is America." Lots of politicians themselves bemoaning what's been going on. Former Indiana Democratic Senator Evan Bayh gave up a safe seat in a couple of years back because he was disappointed with dysfunction in Congress. He talked with CBS News 60 Minutes about how unpleasant the weekly caucus meetings he attended had become.
Everything is so short-term, politically tactical. It's all, how do we win the next vote? How do we, win the next news cycle? How do we win the next election? You buck the party line, there's a price to be paid. What used to be seen as an act of statesmanship, trying to forge consensus across the aisle to move the country forward, is now viewed by many as a betrayal of your party.
From Democrat Evan Bayh, and from the Republican side, on Hannity in December, here's Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky.
This is how we've been running government for a decade. We lurch from deadline to deadline, and we now have an $18 trillion debt. So it's a terrible, I'm a no vote on it, because I won't get a chance to even look at the entire bill before we can vote on it.
Yeah.
So it's a crummy way to run government.
John Cassidy in New York, I mean, I look at this country and it seems to me on so many fronts, as Joe Nye says, we have fundamental strengths. We ought to be incredibly well positioned, not just in technology and universities and population and maybe energy. We seem to have, if we would only act on it, we've kind of picked the lock of diversity. We've got real problems remaining there, but we understand in our gut what it takes to be a diverse nation and therefore can tap into populations all over the world. I mean, it seems like this could and should be yet another American century, John. But this feeling, I think, is fairly widely shared now that we may be blowing it ourselves. How real is that?
Well, I think that both feelings are right. I mean, to the extent that America is going to be the dominant or co-equal power for the rest of the century, I think that's probably true unless we have some untold catastrophe that we can't see. But at the same time, I think this problem that Professor Nye identifies of mobilizing the underlying strengths is really a very important one. I mean, We see it from inside the U.S., but I think if you read the media, some of the media coverage around the world, for example, of this Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank story, you'll see that to the rest of the world, this just does seem like an example of the U.S. shooting itself in its foot, of its political system impinging on its national interests.
Well, we could have helped reorganize the World Bank in such a way that China remained integrated in this fundamental institution world order.
Sorry, we not only could have done, we did. I mean, there was an agreement reached in 2010 in the G20, which it took years of negotiation, and obviously it's difficult. There's dozens of countries involved. It was finally agreed. All the sort of points of disputation were ironed out, and Congress just turned around and says, "Well, we're not funding it. You know, it's the same. We're not passing it. We're not giving the additional resources which were part of the deal." And it's the same thing with the U.S. UN problem, which has been going on for years. It just never seems to get any better. As you say, I mean, the budget crisis has now been – I've been reporting on Washington since 1987, and it's been going on ever since then. That's nearly 30 years now.
Joe Nye, you say be careful that we don't think of our own time as exceptional in this regard, that it's kind of baked in the cake of the American Constitution to have some level of gridlock in a way, contesting powers anyway. What about the sense that many people share that it is worse now, that somehow we can't do the right thing even in our own interests when it's right in front of our faces?
Well, I think the political system is worse now. I think the effect of big money and the effect of congressional constituencies and districts which are drawn to favor the incumbents does skew our politics. If American opinion is like a camel's hump. I mean, most American opinion is in the center. It's called a bell-shaped curve. Mm-hmm. The political parties are like a camel with two humps. They're not where the center of the American people are. And that's because when you're getting reelected to Congress or when you're trying to get the presidential nomination, you want to make sure nobody beats you to the right if you're a Republican. Nobody beats you to the left if you're a Democrat. And that means instead of doing the middle, you look at the extremes. And I think that the one thing we could do is to have either what the Californians are doing, which is nonpartisan primaries, or what Iowa does, which is to have an impartial districting commission. And I think that that's the type of reform, plus changes in Senate rules and so forth, which could reduce some of the particularly bad spell that we're going through now.
You quote Michael Lind, who everybody can date the American century in a different way. You started from around 1941, beginning of World War II, and he goes all the way back to the eve of World War I, 1914. And he says, in 1914, the American century began. This year, he was writing this a few months ago, the American century ended. Michael Lind writes, American foreign policy is in a state of collapse. America's economy doesn't work well, and American democracy is broken. The days when other countries looked to the U.S. as a successful model of foreign policy, prudence, democratic capitalism, and liberal democracy may be over. The American century, 1914-2014, RIP, rest in peace. Then you say, wait a minute.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I wrote the book. I think this extreme pessimism lacks a sense of historical perspective. It's worth remembering that there have been times when things have been even worse. I would argue we were more divided on foreign policy during the McCarthy era about who lost China and how to have a policy toward Asia and so forth than we are today. So it's not as though this is the first time we've been through this type of thing. I do think that we're in a low dip right now on partisanship. But I think there have been equally low dips in the past.
John Cassidy, Americans with their own concerns about this, what about the rest of the world looking on at the United States? We imagined for a long time and very happily that we were the city on the hill. We were the model that drew all. Joe Nye has written about this very powerfully, talking about soft power. What about the U.S. as a model today, John?
Well, I think the U.S. model still does exist. I mean, if you just look at the last few days, we've seen the death and now the funeral soon of Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore, who is in many ways the sort of most influential statesman in Asia over the last half a century. Mm-hmm. And the model of economic progress which he imported to Singapore basically copied most of the West, most of the U.S. Aspects, apart from liberal democracy. But in terms of free markets, rule of law, pragmatism, meritocracy, universal public education, big stress on higher education. Lee Kuan Yew basically said, look, that's how the West and the U.S. especially got rich. We need to do the same thing. Now, he didn't introduce democracy, full democracy, of course. But I think that model still is out there. But now, because of the success of Singapore and China, we've got an alternative model on the shelf, which is this sort of authoritarian capitalist model, where you do all the sort of capitalist things, which make you a big, powerful economic power, and you don't introduce messy democracy. And a lot of Asians look at American democracy at the moment and they say, well, maybe that's a pretty good deal because we get all the material benefits of having a free market economy, but we don't have to deal with all the dysfunction you get in Washington. So I think there is one of the things which has changed is that there is a sort of a rival paradigm being put out there to the American model. There always was, of course, in terms of sort of Soviet communism and Chinese communism, but it wasn't a very attractive one. You know, people were trying to run away from it at any opportunity they could. This new model seems to be more popular.
Jonai, are those the stakes? Is it kind of emerging? If John talks about how whether the U.S. will be dominant or co-equal, of course, he means with China at some level there, or perhaps with others as well. But is this about whether it will be markets have been potent in growing economies? But what about the freedom piece, the piece about democracy? Is that what is on the line here?
I think that is part of it. But I John Cassidy mentioned Lee Kuan Yew. I was having lunch with him a few years ago and asked him if he thought China would pass the U.S. Mm-hmm. He said no, he thought China would give us a run for our money because they could draw on the talents of 1.3 billion people. But he said America will stay ahead because it can draw on the talents of 7 billion people. And then it can bring the world, and then they can bring them to this country and combine them with a diversity which is much greater in terms of creativity than you get in ethnic Han nationalism. I think that's the secret of American success, that degree of openness.
Is there a point, though, John, in which you fly into JFK Airport and you look around or you go over to LaGuardia and it's falling apart and you've just come in from some spiffy, bright, sparkly new airport abroad and you say, wait a minute, this is the great magnet?
Well, I agree.
I mean, Singapore is a classic example. I mean, if you go to Singapore Airport and then fly into JFK, as I did a few years ago, it really does look like you're going from the advanced world to the less developed world. Now, of course, that's just one instance. I wouldn't make the argument that Singapore is ahead of us in a lot of other ways. But I think there is a sort of pervasive feeling, I think, around the world that the U.S. political system, which for centuries has been the great advantage of the country, partly because, as Professor Nye says, it was so open to outsiders and immigrants and entrepreneurs from around the world, is not as strong as it was. And I think maybe the test case will be this immigration issue. Sure, at the moment we're still an open country, but you know there are currents in Congress and around the country who'd like to close a lot of the borders. And you know, the sort of openness of America, which Lee Kuan Yew talked about, isn't you know built into the fabric of the Constitution. It could go away.
The New Yorker's John Cassidy with us. His recent piece, The Biggest Threat to America's Future is America. Joseph Nye is here. His new book, Is the American Century Over? Aaron is calling from Norman, Oklahoma. Aaron, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, number one, I was really glad to hear you guys talk about the ineffectiveness of the Congress being built into the idea. If I remember correctly from my politics class, one of the main reasons they had that was because that things became so poor when King George III had the control of the country that they wanted to be able to move slow, because even though they knew that a system that moved fast could do a lot of good, a system that moves fast can also move to a lot of bad very quickly. I think that's probably one of the things that disillusions the youth so much, is that we see a problem, but we don't see a solution quick enough. The second thing I was going to note is that though we see that, I think that also speaks to the problem of American society having that idea of instant gratification.
As opposed to what, maybe an Asian model where you're saving and you're squirreling away for the future. We'll look at that. Aaron, thanks for calling. We're talking about the American future, about American dysfunction. Jonai, in this built-in unwieldiness of the American political system, nebevertheless, there are an ebb and flow of effectiveness. Where do we stand in that now? If people feel like, my gosh, we've never been this screwed up before, is it true?
I don't think it is true. There have been times when politically we've been as screwed up. I mentioned a couple of them.
Red Scare and McCarthy.
Yeah, and also in the 1930s when Franklin Roosevelt was trying to get us to see the threat from Hitler, he gave several speeches and even the great communicator couldn't do anything about it. He turned to his speechwriter, Sam Roseman, and said, what do you do if you're a leader of a democracy and you look over your shoulder and nobody's following?
It took Pearl Harbor,
and it
ultimately.
It took Pearl Harbor. But I think that as we look at the U.S. situation, it's worth remembering that we're less dependent on Washington than, say, Britain is on London or Paris dominates France. A lot is happening in this country despite the problems that of Washington. Over the last 5 years, which many people think is a difficult period, we've reduced health care costs, we've diminished our dependence on imported energy, and we've got unemployment down to 5.5%, whereas in Europe, for example, unemployment is double that.
Mm-hmm.
So for all the complaints, and they are justified about Washington, doesn't mean the society is stagnated.
So do you think the concern over America's standing in the world is overwrought? Is this just a creation of a media that constantly needs something to fret about?
Well, we always exaggerate. In the you quoted John F. Kennedy at the start of the program.
Barony Burden.
It's worth remembering that he got elected on a complaint that America was in decline and that Eisenhower wasn't protecting us against the Soviets who were outpacing us. So this is not new in American politics to have these feelings of psychology of things are worse than they've ever been before. This is without saying that we don't have a problem now. We do, but it helps to put it in a historical perspective.
Danny in New Orleans. Danny, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I have a question. Speaking of historical perspective, I had a question about the way that this question is being framed.
Mm-hmm.
The American century was not the only way in the 1940s of thinking about the best way forward for America. And when Henry Luce brought that term forward, he was thinking about American commercial dominance and in terms of dominance in international relations. But Henry Wallace also introduced the competing term, the century of the common man.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if thinking about America's future primarily in terms of dominance as we are in this conversation doesn't also distract from very important issues related to quality of life. If we're all out pursuing commercial or foreign policy dominance, that can have real costs in terms of, labor and individual dispensations of leisure time.
Danny, I love it. I maybe have been casually equating American standing in the world with quality of life at home. John Cassidy, is that a necessary equation?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, if you look at the survey data on sort of quality of life and how people view their life relative to other people in the world, the U.S. does okay. We're in the sort of top middle rank, but we're certainly not at the top. Other countries seem to score higher, Scandinavian countries, et cetera, where tend to have more equal distributions of income, and some people think that's linked to it. But it's not the case that Americans are a lot less happy than everybody else. We're just sort of pretty much the same as the rest of the developed world.
If we don't keep that international standing, Joe, does it come back to bite our quality of life at home, or is somehow the way we've pursued that international standing, Danny suggests, handicapped our quality of life at home?
Well, I think our quality of life at home can be independent of our international standing. But if we
really
do more about our quality of life at home, it'll raise our international standing. In other words, you can do things at home which can address, let's say, the problems of inequality. And I think that will help our standing internationally. But if you ask, will we remain powerful even if we haven't solved the problems of inequality, I think the answer is yes.
That's a picture, maybe not a picture we want to go to, maybe not the ideal.
I didn't say that's a preference.
but there it stands. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's future and American, what, gridlock, dysfunction, how long this country can or will stay on top, number one, and how our decisions, our politics, our behavior now factor into that in a changing world. Joseph Nye is with us, professor, former dean of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, author of Is the American Century Over? New book just out, excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. John Cassidy is with us, terrific writer for The New Yorker. His recent piece headlined, The Biggest Threat to America's Future is America. You can link to that at our website as well, and you can join us. Here's legendary investor, co-founder of the Quantum Fund, Jim Rogers, talking with CNN a couple years ago about why he thinks Asia has a better economic future than America.
It's easier to get rich in Asia than it is in America now. The wind is in your face. We're the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. In China, I mean, all the assets in the world.
Are you bearish America?
Aren't you? Don't you know we're the largest debtor nation in the history of the world? I don't like saying this. I'm an American taxpayer and citizen like you.
Are you bearish on America? Aren't you? Well, flash forward, and here we are just last week, ignoring pleas from the Obama administration after Congress did not give a green light to a restructuring of the World Bank, the International Monetary World Bank, that would have let China and others have a more seat at the table, in scale with their current standing in the world. European powers decided to jump in and join China's Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. Here's German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble. Saying we agree that infrastructure investments are of vital importance for Asia's further development. That's why we welcome the Chinese intention to found an infrastructure bank for Asia with additional partners and on we go. Germany, France, Italy, the UK. Washington said, please do not go there. They did, after the United States failed to act. Henry in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Henry, you're on the air.
Yes, please. I actually think it would be good for the world if the United States came down a couple steps. If you look over the last century or so, we've been terrible, actually, on a number of nations we've invaded. Our economic policies have really hurt numerous countries and the people in those countries. I do not think that we've been good leaders of the world, and we need a little more world democracy.
Henry, let us pick it up. John Cassidy, how about it? A good thing if the United States comes down or has brought down a peg or a couple of pegs.
I mean, it's probably a common view around the world in the last 10 or 15 years, but I think it's probably better to take a historical perspective. I mean, America did play a very positive role after the Second World War, which was when the modern sort of international era was basically founded, in setting up the IMF, the World Bank, the Marshall Aid to Europe, rebuilding Japan, etc. All these things helped America to project what Professor Nye calls soft power around the world. It was sort of enlightened hegemony on America's part. Everybody knew America was number one, but they seemed to be benevolent number one, and people were willing to go along with America on a lot of things. So America didn't actually have to exercise its power and order people around. People looked to America for a lead, thinking that America was playing a positive role around the world.
Of course, John's not wrong that America did exercise its power in all kinds of ways.
And then obviously, you know, there have been lots of instances more recently where we've done terrible things. The Iraq War obviously comes to mind, which, who knows? It's too early to say, but a lot of people would argue that more than anything else has undermined American standing around the world in the last 15 years.
Joe Nye, if the U.S., let some of these what you call potentially critical problems of dysfunction in converting our strengths into real power. If we let that go on and we do come down a few notches here, what are the implications of that? We've grown up, most of us, in a world where American perspectives were dominant. If we go instead to, let's say, a Lee Kuan Yew view of the world, or Chinese, or authoritarian capitalism, or Communist Party, you name it. What's it mean?
Well, we are coming down a few notches. We began and ended the 20th century with a quarter of the world's economy. And now we're probably down around 23-22%.
And you remind us that in between those, we were
we
up to
gone
half.
Up to 50.
After World War II,
right.
Those were felt like pretty good, deep gravy times, pretty good times.
But if we go down to what the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, expects to be 18-20%, we'll still be very powerful. And The question, though, is how are we going to make sure that China shares in some of the burdens on this? How do they produce the public good of an international financial stability? I frankly think an Asian infrastructure development bank mm-hmm. is a good thing, and I don't think we should have opposed it. Similarly, you know, if you look at the Law of the Sea Treaty, which our Senate has not ratified, we need that to help produce a stable international order. And we've had numerous chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and former secretaries of state who've testified about this. And it's being blocked by a small minority of Republican senators. The problem
Why?
Is, well, because of sovereignty. It seems to mean that we're giving up sovereignty, even though Ronald Reagan had in effect said we can go ahead and do this. So this ability of a very small minority to block things, for example, on this reform of the International Monetary Fund, which John Cassie referred to in 2010, I was talking to a very influential Republican senator and asking, why are your fellow Republicans blocking this? So it's not all of us. It's just a few. And they're basically far out in terms of this sovereignty issue. So we've got to learn to grow up and realize that a world in which we're going to get things done when we're down a peg or two is going to require us to cooperate with others better than we've done in the last few years.
John Cassidy, you hinged a rather alarming article, though, on the emergence of this Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank as a signifier of things changing, not for the good. What about it?
Well, I think, you know, it raises the whole question, which is the sort of central question facing the U.S. at the moment, of how to deal with the rise of China. And there are two sort of options there. One is accommodation and one is containment. When the British agreed to join the Asian Bank over the objections of Washington, an anonymous but senior official in Washington, presumably somebody high up in the State Department or White House, gave an interview saying the problem with the British is they're always accommodating China. Now, to most people around the world, that looks like a good thing to do. I mean, there's, you know, if you look at some of the commentary elsewhere, what else can we do but accommodate China? We need to accommodate them where possible and give them a stake in the New World Order, which this Asian Development Bank would do, and try to make them, you know, play with the rules of the game that have been in place for 50 or 60 years. The idea that we can somehow contain China and keep them down, which is what the Chinese think the so-called pivot to Asia is. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but that's how it's viewed in China. I think, you know, is a big worry. And I think some of those worries are shared by some of the US's other allies in Europe and even in other parts of Asia. So I think it does raise this whole issue. Even though, as I say, in itself, you know, the future of the Asian Development Bank isn't, Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank isn't going to determine the rise or fall of the U.S. I think it's a straw in the wind, and you know, it should be a wake up call to the United States.
With economic implications for the United States, you're saying, and or we've been able to assume that our values were sort of predominant, and maybe they wouldn't be. I mean, how would it feel for Americans 20 years from now to live in a world where authoritarian, let's say, capitalism was the reigning sort of power structure?
Yeah, I mean, that's a much broader debate. I mean, I'm sort of optimistic on this, and I'm hopeful that the sort of authoritarian capitalist model won't prove to be sort of permanent. If you look at Singapore, for example, where it originated, there are now calls for more democracy. In the last election, which took place in 2011, the opposition party got 40% of the vote. There's other new elections coming up in 2017. It's possible that we'll have the first alternative government there, not ruled by the People's Action Party, since the 1950s. So Singapore may be on the road to not authoritarian capitalism, but democratic, full democratic capitalism. And seen as that's the great role model, it would have implications for China. So I'm not here, I don't want to sound alarmist saying that sort of liberal democracy is on its way out here, but I think that, you know, these are big challenges, and we need to raise our game, and we need to recognize the new reality in which we exist in, which is a world in which China is going to play a big role, and we need to, you know, accommodate it in some way that we preserve U.S. leadership, but with a bigger role for China.
Joe in Framingham, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Just a couple of comments.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of parallels between what's happening in the U.S. and the Roman Empire, where in the Roman Senate they were more interested in getting rid of Caesar, somewhat of Obama. They built all these stadiums to entertain the people, so most people are Twittering or Facebooking. They're not following the government. They hired mercenary, which Romney mentioned, you know, would be a good idea instead of the U.S. military. You know, people don't want the draft, they don't want to fight, but they want to go to all these places. And Rome got a lot of debt by just doing all of these things, and basically the rich sort of took over. They kept spending money. See a lot of common occurrences between what's happening in the U.S. with the dissociated citizenry, focus on religion, and not really the kind of nationalism we had before.
Joe, it goes right into Jonai's wheelhouse, and we'll go there with you. Jonai, what about Rome, the U.S.? You hear the parallels that our caller's pointing
to. Well, there are frequent comparisons between Rome and the U.S. There are two problems with that comparison. One is if you say Rome declined, it's worth noticing it took over 300 years, and also,
whereas by your accounting, the American century began in 1941, we're still only 75 years into it.
We have time to go, but probably even more important, it's worth noting that Rome's economy had no productivity. It grew by conquering. If you look at the American economy, as I described earlier, mm-hmm. it has a high rate of productivity. The other thing that Rome suffered from was it had internecine warfare. People were killing each other. While we fight with each other in political terms, we haven't gotten to the point of replacing ballots with bullets. Indeed, one of the great marvels is that we still keep a democratic process.
But what about the distracted citizenry, the obsession, as our caller would have it, on bringing down the leader?
Well, I think that is a problem, but I also think that it's not new. Go back to my example of Jefferson and Washington and Adams and the Founding Fathers. When you read a little bit about how bitter the disputes were among the Founding Fathers, you realize that some of the bitterness in politics today has deep roots.
Mary in Pawleys Island, South Carolina. Mary, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. You're on, Mary.
I think our government is so ridiculous that we should not even participate. I think there should be a coalition of people that refuse to vote, refuse to participate. They need a certain number of votes to elect a president. And the average person thinks it's ridiculous. Like, even all the stuff that you're talking about today, it has nothing to do with the average person in this country. And people don't like it. They don't care about it. They want a better life. Our life is getting worse and worse, and we should just not participate anymore.
What do you think is driving the problem, Mary? What's driving the problem?
The lobbyists, for one thing, in Washington, our representatives do not represent us. They represent big money. That's all they represent. That's all they care about. They said from the beginning that they were not going to let Barack Obama be successful, and they're doing everything they can not to let him be successful, just like the health care issue. They keep going back. They're trying to get rid of the reform, the health care reform. They don't want – why don't they want people in this country to be able to go to the doctor? Seriously.
Seriously heard as well, Mary. Jonai, how about it? Lobbyists sort of driving things off the rails here, and Mary's fed up, hands up in the air.
Well, I sympathize with Mary about lobbyists and big money. I think when the Supreme Court and Citizens United opened the floodgates on money, that was a big mistake. And I also think, as I mentioned earlier, that we could do things to improve the rules in the Senate so a minority of senators cannot hold important policies hostage. We can change the congressional districting process, and there are a variety of things which could improve our process. With all that said, I don't think I agree with Mary that things are getting worse for the average citizen. More people are covered in health care costs today. Health care costs overall have come down. Unemployment has come down to 5.5%, and the country is growing at 2.5%. This is not a picture of things getting worse. We could do better than that. But it's not one in which things are getting worse.
John Cassidy, Americans look at this with a considerable sense of unease at what's going on at home and about global standing. What would you tell people to do or look for to try and push things in a favorable direction?
Well, I agree with Professor Nye that we could try and change the rules of the game in Washington to sort of empower the center somehow. But it's a lot easier said than done, obviously, with the Supreme Court as it is at the moment. I mean, it is very depressing when you look at it. I mean, if you think about Obama back in 2008, he was elected on this idea of overcoming partisanship and taking a pragmatic problem-solving approach to things. And in some ways, he succeeded. But Joe Nye mentions the healthcare reform. We managed to avert a great recession. Job growth is actually very strong now, although wage growth is weak. So there have been some very notable successes. But I think even Obama himself would say he hasn't been able to overcome the divisions in Washington and the sort of structural weaknesses of the U.S. political system.
Clock ticks on the American century. John Cassidy at The New Yorker, wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
John Cassidy at The New Yorker. His piece, The Biggest Threat to America's Future is America. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Joe Nye, you take the American century out to 2041, no further. That's only 25 or 6 years from now. That's not exactly super comforting. Children today won't be very old when that time is up.
Well, we don't know about after that. I'm not saying it's not. I'm just taking a date which we can check each other on.
A bite at a time. Joseph Nye, author of Is the American Century Over? His answer, no. We'll watch that. Joe, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.